So we'll make sure you have lots of cake and pasta, bring the lights down low, and we'll talk about the future. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk about some of what we're doing. As Jane mentioned, I've had a chance to come and hang out in Springfield a bit, and always a chance to come to Illinois is always a good thing. So I appreciate the opportunity. The future is ours for the taking. Sometimes people accuse me, and I think it is more of an accusation, of being the future guy. Oh, Dave's going to talk about the future of this and the future of that. I think if you want someone who's going to talk about the future, I think you should hire a psychic, because I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm much more of a current guy. I'm much more interested in what we can do today and what we can look at today to make things happen. And so this notion of the future is ours for the taking, I feel, where that theme comes from is really that we control the field of librarianship. I think all too often we think that because it's been around for a couple of thousand years and because the schools teach it and because there's someone in, you know, directors and whatever, that someday somehow we abdicate the responsibility for shaping and moving this profession. You know, the idea of librarianship is its durability, how it's lasted has not been through not changing. It's because it has been able to change and adapt to current situations and current circumstances. You know, farming changes. We still have farmers, but I don't think that they're worried about having the oxen, you know, have the, you know, cleft rock being pulled down the mud all the time. Right? The same way, I don't think we really spend a lot of time in library school talking about how to chain books to shelves and to make sure that we copy the illuminated manuscript properly. Though I am thinking of offering elective just on the electric pen for inscribing the spines of books, but not there yet. So let me begin with this slide, which is I believe that the best days of librarianship are ultimately ahead of us, that we are the right profession, uniquely positioned to lead in a knowledge age. However, we won't get there following current trends with our current focus on recorded knowledge and buildings. Now, what's interesting about this slide, I bring it up for two reasons. One, I've noticed since I put this at the beginning of the presentation, more people look at it on my blog, so it's just a blatant marketing effort. I think it's kind of sad that we need someone to, you know, it's a good presentation. Someone said, we have a job tomorrow. Yay! That's not where we want to be. The other reason I bring up this slide is I used it last week at talking to public librarians in the state of Pennsylvania, their district library system. And when I literally read the first bullet, the best days of librarianship are ahead of us, this really kind, wonderful, smart woman right in front of me went, and I didn't quite know how to take that. I'd like to get sort of emotional and rah-rah, but, you know, if you're just going to blow me off like that on the first slide, I'm doomed. And, you know, I think, thinking about it, you know, she has every right to do this. I mean, you know, we can take a look at things like, you know, this is Cornell University Libraries that's going to have a 7-9% cut of $2.3 million. You know, we see these announcements where, you know, the University of Tennessee's got to get rid of $1.3 million. MIT's cut $1.4 million. Here's Emory University's got to get rid of 6% of its budget. It's hard to look at the current circumstance and say the best days are ahead of us. I mean, I understand. I'm not oblivious. When I posted one presentation with this, I got a comment going, what world does he live in? And I said, sadly, the same one you do, in the sense that I know these are tough times. And if you're at public institutions, they're tougher than if you're at tuition-driven private institutions. And if you're at smaller community colleges, I get it. But here's the thing. If we look at that current circumstance and we believe that this is somehow a trend line, we have a problem. The economic uncertainty, the economic tsunami that hit us, the Great Recession, is not a trend. If it is a trend, then we have much bigger problems than library budgets ahead of us. You know, dark ages and things like that. So, actually, what was it, the Treasury Secretary at the beginning of the Great Depression, they asked, well, how long could this go on? And he said, well, you've heard of the dark ages, haven't you? Yeah. So that's what you want a Treasury Secretary to say. So I do understand that the climate that we're talking in is a tough climate. But I would also argue that it is an opportunity for us. And if all we look at is, this doesn't allow us to keep doing what we've always done, I would agree wholeheartedly. I will draw your attention back to this slide where I say, however, we won't get there following current trends with our current focus on recorded knowledge and buildings. We need to change. But I want to be really careful. When I say we need to change, there are things about the profession, there are things about librarianship that should not change, that are durable and should last through that 1,000-year-plus conversation about what it means to be a librarian. But there are many ways in which we enact those principles, enact those visions, enact those values that should change radically. And in fact, I would argue that now is a really good time to have that conversation. So in order to move us along on that conversation, I want to give you two thought experiments. All right, I'm an academic, I'm a professor type, all we do is think, right? There's a great discussion someone made about how education destroys creativity. And they say, you know, it starts early, that when you're a kindergartner, education focuses on your whole body. You can dance and you can sing and you can move. And as you move up the grades, like our attention slowly moves up your body. So, you know, by second grade, we don't dance anymore. And, you know, pretty much by the time you're high school, we give up on gym classes. And, you know, we hope you don't think below this level in middle school. He says, because if you look at it, what's the ultimate result of our formal education system? It's the college professor type. Right? In which case, what happens is we have moved all the way up into our head, slightly to the left, and see our body's only utility is to take us from meeting to meeting to meeting. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm all the way up and slightly to the left. So some thought experiments. The first one comes from a fellow by the name of Bill Arms, who's a professor at Cornell, and he asked this question. I thought it was a brilliant question. He said, imagine you have a new college president, new provost, new sort of grand poobah for the academy. And every department's asked to identify their star. Everyone's identified to ask one person who's going to go out and impress the hell out of this person. Right? So the economics people, they pull out a Nobel laureate, you know, and the physics people, they pull out this, and et cetera, et cetera. What is it that the library would send to that meeting? What made that person a star? And he said there's a very important criteria for being a star. It's not just a matter of being a star amongst your peers. It's a matter of doing something, having some accomplishment that is also easily and readily identifiable as valuable from the other people who have come. Right? In essence, you don't have to show up and prove yourself. People will say that's the value. So ask yourself, what is it? What's the contribution that the librarians have made that not only advances the institution, but is recognized as a contribution across disciplines, right? Thought experiment number one. In order to answer this thought experiment, I want to actually walk you through a second one. And this one was posed to me by David Fenske, who's the dean of Drexel, a competitor and, frankly, a second-rate library program. If you're considering it, Syracuse, where to go. No, I like David. I like him a lot, and he makes me think, which is even better. And he said, is there a way of defining librarianship and what we do without a reference, without referral to the physical facility? In essence, can you define a librarian without a library? Can you define them not as someone who collects stuff? It's not someone who shelves stuff. Not someone who works in this building. By the way, I just like to get this right out in the open. They name the building after us. Right? And you sit there, oh, we're the only institution that, you know, we're named after a building. Well, technically, librarian comes from the I think it's Greek, or maybe the Latin root, liber, which means bark of tree, because that's what they used to write on. So technically, you're all forest rangers, if you really want to play the name game. Right? So that's the thought experiment I want to take on. What is a librarian without a library? And I want to argue that there are three fundamental things that make us a field, a vocation, a calling. The first of those is a focus on conversation. And I'm going to break these down a little bit more thoroughly here. But that librarians are about conversations. That those conversations may be facilitated by, encoded within, recorded in artifacts and books and videos and whatever. But ultimately, we're about conversations. The second is that we're about facilitation. That when we look at the idea of what we do, oftentimes we are in the role of helping other people do something. Right? So we're in the idea of helping an undergraduate get a great great on a paper, a professor make a profound discovery, an institution make a right decision. Right? So in many ways, our value is measured not in our direct action, but by the results of our direct action. Right? So not in us, but in those that we help. And the third, and I think very most fundamental, is in the values that we bring to this. That, for example, Google can find information. Google can host conversations with Blogger and all these kinds of things, but they don't share the same values that we bring. So it's not so much the tools that we create or use, so much as the intention and reason behind them. I merge these things together into the idea of a mission statement for librarians. And that is, the mission of a librarian is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. Now, a couple things to note about this mission. First of all, it's a mission of librarians, not a mission of building. So you'll notice the title started with the year of the librarian, right? It's like the year of the rat. That's us. Right? Now, I want to say, why do I make that distinction? And some of you are going to talk, I'm doing a little verbal kung fu, but stick with me for a moment. And that is, libraries are all too often either thought of as physical places, the building, or as some abstract royal we organizational chart, the library. And that sort of separation of individual responsibility to institutional responsibility all too often allows us to abdicate responsibility. That we look at it and we say things like, boy, the library's website sucks. As if somehow the building sat around last night and go, blue, red, together, cool. Right? We built it! Right? Someone did it. Or my favorite is, oh, well, I'd love to do this, but the library won't let me. The administration won't let me. They won't let me. There's the idea that somehow we're not a people-created organization. That the way we're structured, oh, we're too bureaucratic. Whose fault is that? It's the people who set up the bureaucracy. God did not say, thou shalt have 12 tiers of gradient service and you shall never speak amongst yourself. Bob Martin once was talking at the State Library of Texas, and the legislator was talking about how he'd like the State Library to do something. Bob Martin looked at him and said, well, sorry, sir, but we are not authorized in our legislation to do that. At which time the legislator sort of looked at him, put down and said, son, we write laws. And the idea here is, we create these structures! Right? This idea that somehow libraries are too conservative, that libraries are too structured or too bureaucratic or too slow moving or too whatever, they're people that put things in the way and there are people who can take things out of the way. The mission we must look at is not what the building does and not what the organizational chart and not what the mission statement says. It's what people put in action. It's what you do. You with your communities are the library. The second thing that you'll notice about this is that it actually is a two-part mission. The first part is to improve society. The second is to facilitate knowledge. Right? That we don't want to simply do things just to create knowledge, like evil bomb building and such, that we want to do this for a purpose. That we want to have an effect. And I think a lot of academic libraries are scratching their head at this point because accrediting agencies are showing up at universities, institutions, and saying, we would like to know what your outcomes are and what the impact of every unit is on the outcomes. And I've seen way too many librarians stop and say, what the hell do you mean? Right? So Joey went to class. Joey went to Econ 101. I have to say how I helped Joey get the A or the outcome? Yes. Right? This notion that we focus not on knowledge and outcomes and impacts and not simply on the notion of we have this many volumes. At Syracuse University, we're in the midst of discussing what is the role of an academic library. And faculty will stand up and look at ARL statistics and say, we are failing because we don't have this many volumes. And I look at them and say, give me $500 and access to dumper diving behind Barnes & Noble, and I will bring your volume count up. Have we succeeded? Right? So we need to worry about this. Now, this breaks down into lots of bits and pieces. Right? What do I mean by facilitation? What do I mean by knowledge? What do I mean by mission? What do I mean by improved society, communities, librarians? I just want to pick on a few of these for something to think about. So let's start with the notion of facilitation. What is facilitation? What does it mean to help people? What is unique about librarianship in that aspect? And I would say that there are a couple of things about facilitation. First thing that we do is we provide access to conversations. That knowledge is created through conversation. We'll get to that in a minute. And so in order to facilitate that, we provide access to those things. Now, classically, that has been defined as access to the artifacts or remnants of conversations. That's what a book is. That's what a web page is. That's what a DVD is. It's recorded artifacts that come out of it. Let us all just take a moment to throw away the term recorded knowledge. It doesn't exist. Never existed. It's an oxymoron. If you record it and encode it, it doesn't exist. Right? If you pick up a rock off the street and you look at it and say, that's a rock. Right? Hand that to a geologist. That will say, well, this kind of rock was formed in this kind of process. It probably came from this location. It's probably this age. That knowledge did not come from the rock. If it did, I could have picked it up and said the same thing. It came from what that person brought to the rock, to the material. So simply providing access to materials is insufficient. We need to provide access to those materials, to other conversations, to people. And it's a two-way street. We need to provide access for other people to get to your conversations. This notion that librarians should go out and blog, okay. What I get really interested about is librarians hosting and facilitating students and faculty in the academy blogging out. That many times we want to create these invisible networks, these invisible colleges. That's a role we can do with access. It's a two-way. It's agency and it's stewardship. But it's insufficient. Simply getting to conversations doesn't work. If it did, we could take a freshman, throw him in the library, come back in 6 months and say, congratulations, here's your degree. Doesn't work that way. Right? If osmosis worked, trust me, my freshman year would have been easier. Sleep with the book. Okay, I'm ready for that test. Right? So access doesn't count. It's important, you have to have it, but it's insufficient. The other thing we have to have is knowledge, which is, okay, you've gotten to that conversation. Do you know what's happening once you get there? That's a great book. It's going to help me a lot. It's in Spanish. I don't speak it. Not so good. I have a public library near us, and they are driven crazy, and I think acceptably so, that they have a lot of people with very basic non-computer literate skills, but skills, manufacturing, custodial work, these kinds of things. And they want to apply for jobs, and there are jobs for custodial workers, manufacturing, all these kinds of things. None of these require computer skills. None of these folks have computer skills. How do these folks have to apply for those jobs? Online. Makes perfect sense, right? And so the idea of saying this is a mismatch. We need, so the librarians are sitting there helping them get things online. What I love about it is they don't stop there. They also then pick up the phone, call the company and say, hello, just wanted to let you know, you're stupid, thanks. No, but think about it. So we can get to the conversation. We sort of know what's going on in that conversation. The next thing we have to worry about is a safe environment, which is once you're there, do you feel like you can participate? How many people in this room are now serving on a committee where the lifespan of that committee is over 25 years old, quarter century? No one goes to ALA, SLA? Right? How many people on those things feel like you had to have been there for the past quarter century to know what the hell is going on? Right? And if you don't, there's someone who has been there for a quarter century who will tell you in 1932 why we decided not to do online proceedings. Right? Not a terribly safe environment, right? So it's not just intellectual safety, it's not just physical safety, which many of our libraries provide, it's also cultural safety. It's the idea that once I get to this conversation, I feel like I can participate. And how we can do it, right? It's like we hired the new librarian. The new librarian, someone who just got the library science degree, and they're going to figure out all this stuff so we don't have to. They could be 98 in a walker with oxygen, but they're the new, here comes that spry new librarian. Blah! Got it. Right? The idea here that they then put this nice little target on their back because the director loves the new librarian and everyone else is like, they don't know what's going on. Very safe environment. The last thing we have to facilitate is motivation. We have to understand why they're there. Why are people coming? Why do they understand that? And we do really well with intrinsic motivation. They sort of overcome all their fears and are willing to come talk to us. Or we, in academia though, we see extrinsic motivation. It's that you guys do this. I know you do. Is the torture of the undergraduate day? You know, that assignment, English 101, engineering, blah, 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 is due the next day. You just line up and wait for them to come and ask for that. I've got to have an article, and it's got to be peer-reviewed. Oh, peer-reviewed. Yeah. And you've got, like, the stack of answers sitting behind the desk, and you're like, oh, really? I mean, assignment. Oh, what a novel concept. do tell. Right? And we then go through this, like, you know, as Sarah Weissman once said, the reference interview is like putting the patron on the rack until they tell you the truth. You know?
All right, I should have done it a week ago. I've made that agreement.
So we have motivation. We can look at the notion of knowledge. What do I mean by knowledge? Well, knowledge, a fellow by the name of Gordon Pass looked at knowledge and he said, well, knowledge comes from conversation. It comes from talking. And not only talking with other people individually, groups talk, societies can talk, countries can talk, and within the individual, we have conversations all the time. If you're literally sitting there going, what the hell is he talking about? Who are you talking to? Right? We talk to ourselves all the time. We have an internal dialogue. This internal dialogue happens not only when we're reading a textbook and trying to figure out what's happening. It happens with literature and fiction where we try and say, that's a new idea, that's a concept. We learn about ourselves through an internal dialogue. So he said a conversation consists of, first of all, the conversants, the people or individual or components having this talk back and forth. They're exchanging language back and forth, and that language sort of sits at two levels. One language is directional. What do we mean by that? Sort of negotiating what we're talking about. And then a higher order language where we actually begin to talk about the content. So think about this for a minute. The conversants, if we look at librarians as conversants within an ongoing dialogue about how we organize the universe, I mean, not that we have any problems with hubris, but as we organize the universe, what language do we develop? Well, we've developed very complex languages. Things like Library of Congress, no, I don't know about complex. Library of Congress, the Dewey Decimal System, Getty Art Architecture, all these kinds of languages. And we've built systems around these languages. And what's great is if you understand these languages, you can really work the system. So when you look at catalogs, and you look at performance of catalogs, and you look at librarians' performance in catalogs, it's like you guys are on cocaine rock stars. I mean, just amazing. You can make that catalog squeal like a pig and bring home the bacon at night. I'm telling you. I just made that metaphor up. I apologize. Anyway. But if you look at, like, the average student, faculty member, Nobel Prize winner, Mensa person looking at that, it's like we shot them in the, you know, it's just... knock them out, let them fall on the keyboard, and they would have done as well. I mean, really, that's what we're talking about. Why? Because they weren't part of that ongoing dialogue. They didn't quite get that cookery meant the idea of cooking. Right? I see I have some Dewey friends. All right. So, language is important. They're exchanging language, and what are they doing with that language is they're trying to come up with agreements. Do you believe this? Do you believe that? Et cetera, et cetera. By the way, the most important agreement that they can come up with, and frankly the favorite in the academy, is agreeing not to agree. That you can simply say, look, we're not gonna settle this one, let's move on, kind of thing. So, we seek agreements. And those agreements aren't facts necessarily, they're beliefs. And they're those beliefs that we use when we interact with the world. If you believe that it's raining outside, right? So I was having this discussion with, Ann Craig at the State Library this morning. She goes, oh, it's a horrible day, I'm gonna drive you. And I'm from Syracuse, and I'm going, it's not snowing, it's a great day, right? We can have a different, we're gonna have to agree not to agree. And that these agreements, we remember them over time. But what's important about memory, and where we're going to go for the rest of my time, is that that memory is relational. How we keep these agreements matter. I want to show you an example of that. This is one of my favorite all-time historian types, James Burke, and he did Connections and the Day the Universe Changed and all that. And he told this story that I think really illustrates when you look at knowledge, when we look at how we organize knowledge and play knowledge, how it works. And he says it's told a story. And the story was that the Pope got tired of sort of crusade of royalty killing each other. And so he decided to, like, send them after someone else. And having a boy 6 and 9 years old, I appreciate this strategy. Right? Stop killing your brother. Go over to their house and kill your brother there. Right? And so what he did is he said, all right, we're going to go free the Holy Land. Let's go. But before we need a warm-up, let's go get those Moors out of Spain. So he sends the crusaders, which, by the way, half of them were Muslim mercenaries, over to take over Toledo. They walk in, they take over Toledo, and what do they find in the middle of Toledo? What they find is library after library after library. And not, you know, in fact, one of these libraries contained more volumes in it out of the 80 they found in the city than all the volumes in France at the time. And what's amazing is they found that they weren't just sort of sitting there. They were being used to develop little things like algebra and zero and this whole idea of, you know, aqueducts, that they were active working libraries. And in fact, when they took it over, they realized that they brought in translators, they brought in, which were mostly Jewish translators, to bring it from Arabic and Greek and back into these different languages. And what happened was, oh, there it is, they did mathematics. What happened was all this knowledge started flooding back into Europe. And in certain city-states, particularly in Italy, say Florence, royalty realized that by understanding this knowledge, not only mathematical, but particularly in law and government, they could actually have greater influence, greater control, greater power. And so what happened was they began hiring tutors to come over and teach them this knowledge. And they had to hire tutors, and eventually they realized that they were all sort of hiring the same tutor, so they built a building and invited people in. This was the beginning of the university system. And so, in fact, why do we wear those funny, funky robes comes from a lot of what the monks were wearing at the time, and tams and things, and frankly, we just like looking ridiculous once a year. But this idea that the modern university grew out of this, and it wasn't until the late 18th century that we begin saying maybe there's a conflict of interest if the students pay professors directly. We should create more established faculties, and the faculties are paid separately. Johns Hopkins started implementing this in a medical context. And so the modern university was born out of an attempt to get the noblemen of Europe stop fighting. Now, that twisty tale that he tells is not sort of causal. There's not a direct line to it. But what I want you to look at that and say, where do you catalog that? What shelf does that go on? Right? That a lot of knowledge and the way we build knowledge, the relationships are very messy, very unique. As we begin to understand the world, we build these very messy networks. And our libraries, as sort of royal bastions of order, don't always serve that well. So, some little comic relief. These are real, honest-to-God, unaltered photos of Vietnamese telecommunication systems. If you drive down the street, if you look at, it's sort of hard to tell if those are two men standing next to wires that are bigger than them. Another one. This is sort of, you know, falling on street corners. How'd you like to wire that one? Here's an intersection. I need some shade. Go stand under the telephone wires. Right? And what I want to point out about this is it works. What's amazing about it, it worked. Why did this happen? Well, sometimes it's competitors pulling multiple wires from multiple telephone systems. Oh, we have internet, we'll drag some more wires. Oh, we have cable. And what they did is they built a workable system. It's not pretty. It's messy. And frankly, within 10 years, they'll probably go back and replace them with a one fiber wire and such. But when they're discovering, when they're building these communication networks, when they're building ways of understanding the world and contacting the world, it's a messy thing. So what we learn from this is that networks of discovery, which are ultimately, I think, the job that librarians are in, are building and facilitating these networks of discovery, they are messy. They are very messy. I once heard Bill Arms, when he got an NSF grant, he said, our theme for this grant was, maybe we'll do something that we wrote about in it. That being that when you go to NSF, they're like, what would you like to know? And we're like, well, we don't know. That's why we call it research, right? You know, it's like, well, tell us what you're going to find at the end. We don't know, right? And so you build these messy networks. You get these grants. You get these things. You lay them out. You begin looking at them, and you begin to realize that everything you thought was wrong. And so you get start, and you get flexible, and you work them out. They're nonlinear. Where you go from one thing does not fit to the next. The idea that if I were to ask you to draw a picture, if I ever ask you to draw a picture, what does the field of librarianship look like? First, you would do it, which is scary. Secondly, it would look amazingly rational and hierarchical. I will guarantee you, you would not have a multiple inheritance among it. Why? Because we've trained you to do that. And because as human beings, we are trained to look for patterns and we're trained to rationalize things that happened in the past. We know this from doing user study after user study. If you ask someone, how did you find information in the library, they will lie to you. They will not know that they're lying to you. They will look you in a straight face, and they will tell you that they started in the catalog, and then they asked the reference librarian, and then they found the book. And in truth, they accidentally wandered in because it was raining. They found a cool book. They started reading it. There was a cute chick going that way. They followed them, right? How'd you do it? Well, I started by going to the library. That's what we do as people. They're nonlinear. They're unique. My version of the world and your version of the world, maybe that's becoming very obvious, are very different. But even two people in the same institution can have radically different views about how that institution is structured. But but In aggregate, when we take all of these messy, non-linear, unique systems and we aggregate them together, an amazing thing happens. We begin to find order and we begin to find structure. Why? Mostly because we're social human beings. We've existed in a social context, so we tend to mean the same thing with the same words. The classic example of that is our tag clouds. Individual tag clouds don't make much sense. But when you begin putting a lot of tag clouds together, things get interesting. This tag cloud, by the way, is built Wordle, Wordle.net, best site in the universe. Wordle.net, I took all the text from the ALA core competencies as recently passed, dropped it in here, and these are the key words. Bigger words, more often. Notice information, kind of important. Notice also that you have the word library and libraries. I took my blog and ran it through as well. This is from my blog. Notice librarianship pops up there. Right? It's actually one of the biggest words, so don't tell me iSchools don't know about libraries. Right? That, in fact, this is sort of indicative. When you look at ALA documents, what are they about? Libraries. What do they tend not to be about? Librarians. Right? They're defining the role of the of you in context to the institution and not your unique role. By the way, let's get really cool. This was, and I'm sorry they're hard to see. This, I know it looks like, oh, great, Dave, you know what your hair will look like in one more year. But someone took all the articles on given, this is in the hard sciences, took all of these and clustered them together. Each dot you can't necessarily see represents a co-cluster of co-authors together. The hairs coming off of it are keywords that came from it. My point of this is bibliometrics 101. I mean, this is old school bibliometrics. This is looking at citation analysis stuff. Right? But suddenly it gets interesting going, oh, there are clusters of people who work together in topics. Someone took this and did the same version for the whole scientific output of the United States. They looked at citation indexes and they found that each one of those dots represents a different study, a different area of study. And each quadrant over here goes from, say, the hard sciences and physics over on this side and social sciences and medicine. And then it moves up to like things like applied sciences, material science. So what we can do from this is we can say that research publications in the United States tend to be skewed towards medicine and the social sciences. They then took it and they ran it across a bunch of different countries and they found different distributions. China tends to do much more research on applied research, materials design, Germany, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But my point of all of this is not a nice hierarchical, rationalized classification that fits into Dewey. This is an organic, messy system. It comes from actual work, and yet we can see utility in this. Imagine running one of these for your institutions and saying, our institutions have publication strengths in XYZ. Fill your grants into it. And it's core librarianship. It's core in the sense that it's about how we facilitate access, knowledge, how the relational knowledge goes together. Fair enough? Now, this to me represents an opportunity gap. Right? The opportunity gap is the difference between knowing and what our traditional academic reward systems are based on. So knowing is relational, connections, interdisciplinary, unique, crazy, messy. Academic reward systems, I have an algorithm for you. You're welcome to write this down. Take pond, subdivide until biggest fish within you are. Think about that for a minute, right? So I don't just study librarianship. I study reference librarianship. I don't just do reference. I do digital reference. Oh, too many people doing that. Not going to get tenure. I do systems and digital reference, right? By the time, I am the world's expert on people doing digital reference on Wednesday from 3 to 5 on Commodore 68. That's me. Tenure, full professor. Thanks so much. But think about that. That's in the academies, and you see provosts right now, and you can literally see their faces like screw up when they go, interdisciplinary! Please talk to each other! Meanwhile, the libraries are going, of course we talk to you all! We do it all like this. Okay? We do all these. Now, librarianship creates value through our ability to see complexity in the world, to navigate the complexity, and to weave together the disparate disciplines within the academic world, not reduction of this complexity to nice, neat piles of categories and artifacts, but a navigable, rich tapestry of relationships, people, and concepts. Our value is not in reduction to a single universal classification, a reduction of collections of materials, but in sense-making and facilitation. So, now that we're trying to suck for oxygen because I'm up at 30,000 feet, let me give you a real pragmatic example. That's Bob. Bob's got to get tenure. I think that if you look at the tenure system in academia, there's this amazing, huge lever that we have yet to grab and pull. And so what happens when Bob goes up for tenure? Well, Bob's got a bunch of stuff. He's got articles he wrote, and increasingly he's got websites that he's put up. He's got a blog. He's got podcasts. He's got all this stuff. And what Bob's going to do is Bob's going to make an order out of that to make it seem, once again, like it made sense at the time as opposed to, I don't know, will this get me tenure? I don't know. And what Bob has to do is Bob has to demonstrate impact for this, which often means Bob has to do a citation analysis. I had a colleague going up for tenure. I said, pick up the phone, call the university library, tell them you need help. You know what they told him? Well, if you give us an hour or you send your GA down, we can show you how to do this. Think about what that was just. In an hour, we can teach you a core skill of librarianship in information organization and bibliometric analysis. In an hour. And it's the most important thing you're going to have in your academic life. Come on down. As opposed to, you know who's going up for tenure. Walk to the door and say, hi, my name's Dave. I'll be your tenure librarian. By the way, I'm actually in the policies that I have to do your citation analysis to ensure validity, ensure that this is a workable process. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go out and I'm going to look through social science citation indexes and science indexes. And I'm going to go to Google Scholar. And I'm going to come up with a citation analysis for you. Now think about what that does. First of all, it makes you the most important person in Bob's life. The best news, by the way, if he gets tenure, he's your biggest fan, and if you don't get tenure, he's gone, so he can't badmouth you. I like this. But the other thing it lets you do is it's now going to give you access to everything that he's published, and increasingly not just the stuff that showed journals. You want to talk about building repositories and, you know, creating open access articles? This is how you get them! And not only that, but we know from this data how it links to co-authors, how it links to, this might link to research, because we're working with all these, and how it links to their collections. And within this, looking at the tenure process, fulfilling an essential and existing role within the academy, fulfilling a high-stakes role in which you have a vital role to play, fulfilling one that's going to endear you to the faculty, you also now build up a network of how the conversations and knowledge within your community exist. It drives me nuts that my chancellor knows more about my healthcare status at the university than they do about my intellectual contributions. They can go with a few clicks and say, Dave got a cold last week, but they can't tell me I'm presenting in Illinois today. They can't find out what the citation impact is. Is that nuts for an academy that's geared around teaching and research that we know more about human resources than we do about teaching and research? And librarians can be playing the role of connecting these and collecting these. We also need to realize that we need to apply this to ourselves. The shift away from reductionism, strict hierarchy, and the embrace of complex meshes must also be applied to ourselves. Already we know the rigid distinction of library types are at best a trope that we tell ourselves. Ask the community college librarian the difference between a public and an academic library. Ask the librarian at a small liberal arts college with the current focus on assessment how different they are from a progressive school librarians. Right? Ask the college law librarian to identify the bright line that divides the differentiation between them and and their corporate colleagues. Sorry. I write this so I don't screw up. We must see beyond rigid class systems where we gain value through differentiation to a much more unified and powerful whole of societal change agents dedicated to the improvement of our communities through knowledge, facilitation, and values. This brings me to the answer to Penske's question. What is a librarian without a library? The answer is a librarian, one who facilitates knowledge, one who understands knowledge, one who takes values into knowledge development and conversations. Now, this does not discount the utility or power of place materials. It simply puts them in the perspective of tools. I am not telling you to go back and make everyone happy by turning all of your rooms into classrooms, burning the books, closing around, saying, wee-hee. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, why are the books there? The books are there to serve a purpose. They're not there as your purpose. That building serves a purpose. It is not there as your purpose. You can be a librarian and you can be embedded within academic disciplines. You can be in Tibet and helping people here in Springfield by being a librarian, by helping facilitate knowledge, work through information, understand their conversations, connecting them. Facilitating knowledge and knowledge creation then leads to the answer to Bill Arms' thought experiment, right? What is the fundamental recognizable contribution of library science within the academy? Cohesive set of skills and concepts that through action fuse the intellectual work of the academy to improve the university and the society they're in. And now is the time to do it. Right? Rahm Emanuel is accredited for saying, never let a crisis go to waste. Now is the time to do it. Now is the time to think about how we can change things. Our materials budgets are gone. Fine. Do you need those materials? Are there other things you can do? What else can we provide? What other services? You know, if only we were embedded in here, if only we had more staff, and you know, cut the budget for the materials that help us buy more librarians. Right? Become the CIO, the Chief Integration Officer. Right? Integration officer that weaves together the myriad threads of research into a new fabric of understanding. You want those provosts to screw up their faces about interdisciplinary efforts? Stand up first and go, that's me. You want to know what research is going on? I'm in those departmental meetings, and I'm in those departmental meetings, and I talk with my colleagues, and every day we see how this university makes a difference. Every day we see the questions they ask, and every day we can bring those together into a picture that shows how this university has more and more value. I am the person who can weave these things together. Let them be brilliant in their small ponds. Let me be brilliant in building the ocean out of them. Now is the time not to retreat to the safety of our stacks, to cower with meager budgets and small ideas hoping that no one will know, or simply give us a little sympathy. Now is the time for bold action. For renegotiating the compact between librarians and the academics they serve, now is the time to test everything and seek fitness of our services and our ideas. Those who pass the test should be kept. Those that cannot be measured up, ruthlessly discarded. Because if we do not set bravely to embrace a new librarianship unencumbered by static routine and inertia, we shall find that those stacks are very, very unsafe places indeed. Thank you very much.